It's the Kevin Sheehan Show. Denton Day sitting in for Kevin here on the Team 980. You can find me on Twitter at the Denton Day. Coming up in about 30 minutes, I'll tell you where Frankie Louvu wound up on the NFL's top 100 list. I know that's the information everybody is here for. But now we go to the phones. We welcome on friend of the program, Eric Flack, WUSA 9, who's good enough to join us on what I'm sure has already been a crazy day, Eric, and I don't think it'll slow down anytime in the next couple of hours. What was your initial response when you saw the first of the two social media posts that Donald Trump put out about the team name yesterday?
On a tarmac a couple weeks ago when he was asked about the stadium by a reporter, he said, you know, DC council needs to get it done. And then the same reporter kind of lobbed a question about what about the name? And he's like, well, they should change the name, of course. And so I'd heard that part. So the initial post on Truth Social kind of just addressed that they need to change the name and the Indians need to change the name, or excuse me, the Guardians need to change the name back to the Indians. It was the second post when he started making threats about holding up the RFK deal that I think people started going, oh, like here we go. I think this president has proven unpredictability is kind of his calling card. And so I think to say I was totally surprised would be a bit of an overstatement. But obviously, you know, my initial question became, well, can he do it? Can he hold up or block the RFK deal? And through talking through some of my sources, the answer is yes. He can do what he's threatening to do. So now the question really becomes, where do we go from here?
So that was going to be my next question for you, is can he do it? And then the follow-up being, what is the process like for him to do it? Is it an easy process, or is it something that he would have to, or people around him would have to jump through many hoops to make sure it's blocked?
So the simplest route would be for him to sign an executive action canceling the lease that was under debate and scrutiny for so long, that was voted on in the early morning hours by Congress, giving D.C. the right to build the stadium, build the new stadium on the RFK land. He can cancel that lease for a number of different excuses or reasons. He can say that DC is violating the lease agreement by not honoring the terms to act to redevelop it. Basically saying DC council isn't taking action, so they're not redeveloping it, and redeveloping it in some form or fashion is a term of the lease. So they are violating it, so I'm going to cancel it. That would probably end up in court. The city could, challenge that in court. Courts have been, siding with the president for the most part. But even if the city did, in fact, challenge it in court, you're talking about huge delays and the process getting caught up in court, which would be, kind of a disaster, because the team has made it clear that they're under a timeline to get the new stadium built, because they want to open it by 2030. So getting this caught up into a legal process would be, a nightmare scenario for the city and for the team. But there are other ways he can do it, too, kind of more procedural, under the radar ways. There's something called the National Capital Planning Commission. That's a group that casts critical votes on construction projects, including RFK. Like, all big construction projects have to go through the National Capital Planning Commission. And President Trump just appointed three board members to that National Capital Planning Commission. So people who run have critical votes on that National Capital Planning Commission have those votes, as a result of President Trump putting them there. So clearly he would have sway over how they felt. And if he wanted votes to block an RFK deal, he would have them on that National Capital Planning Commission. Very similarly, the Commission of Fine Arts that reviews design aesthetics for all DC construction to make sure it's in line with the aesthetic look of DC. Once again, President Trump has appointed board members to the Commission of Fine Arts. Another way he could pull levers behind the scenes to have votes block the progress and development and ultimate approval of the RFK design once it gets to that point. So, you know, obviously there are legitimate ways he can do this if he chooses to. So now the kind of the ball, pun intended, is in D.C. Council's court, whether or not this speeds up action to act before President Trump can block this. We're here actually, as I speak to you, at a press event that Mayor Bowser is going to be at to see what she has to say about everything.
So I was going to ask about that because you texted me a couple minutes ago saying that you had this presser coming up here at 11. Was this something that was already in the works prior to the other day, or did this come out because of that?
Yeah, we're at a big behind the scenes unveiling for the National Geographic Museum, which is down in downtown DC, which is going to be a big deal to downtown. So that was already planned. But a lot of times it's at these types of events when news breaks that we get availability to ask the mayor about other things going on. And this is one of those opportunities.
Eric Flack with us here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Dent Day sitting in for Kevin. WUSA 9 has been all over the stadium stuff over the course of years now, which is crazy to say, Eric, but you've done a great job covering it. So you mentioned some of the stuff he could do to block the stadium coming back to RFK. Is there also a potential he could make life difficult if they wanted to rebuild a new one in Maryland for the same reasons?
No, because, I mean, you're talking about the lease cancellation. The National Capital Planning Commission is D.C.-based. Commission on Fine Arts is D.C.-based. No, it would open the way. Maryland would be fine. And again, I mean, you know, we just have to see how whether or not this is one of those things that President Trump says and then moves on to something else, or how committed he is to this. You know, if you look at what he actually said, he said, "I may put a restriction on them that if they don't change the name back to the original Washington Redskins, they won't make a deal for them to build a stadium." Well, the deal is already made. They're not going to change the name back to Redskins. That's just not going to happen. So, the reality of how far he's going to push this, I think, is one of the parts that remains to be seen. But obviously, D.C. Council is now playing with fire even more than they were to this point, by kind of dragging their feet and dragging out this process.
Has Mayor Bowser addressed the name since Dan Snyder sold it? I know she was very adamant years ago, but that always kind of felt like it was more directed at Dan himself than the name. Has she addressed the name conversation since the Josh Harris group took over?
I don't expect to hear anything other than, you know, the name isn't going back. Now, I mean, I do think there's a question I want to ask her, which is, you know, because I don't think you can rule anything out. If the name were to be changed back, would you still support a stadium here in the district? I expect that she will not even answer that, because she will say it's such a non-starter. But, you know, she had said for many years that she doesn't support the team's return to D.C. with the old name. But she ultimately, once it became clear that that name was going to change, she had a lot of runway to then get behind the stadium agreement. And so you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, once the name was changed, and then certainly once Josh Harris took over the team, the name just hasn't been an issue, anything that she had to address in any serious form or fashion until now.
So, Eric, I'll get you out of here on this before you go to this press conference. Can he force, he being the president, can he force the NFL to make the change, or is that not feasible?
No. The NFL is a private entity. Now, you know, one of the conversations I had with somebody on the mayor's team here before I got on the phone with you, and I think it's a fair point, is that Donald Trump, you know, really likes his connections to the NFL. He's friends with Goodell. He had that big press conference talking about the NFL draft being on the National Mall. And the NFL and Goodell, they all want the stadium in D.C. So, like, to the extent that he is taking this stand, he's taking it and riling up the NFL, because it's a problem for them, too. They want the NFL, Goodell, they all want the stadium on the RFK land. They don't want to be building the Commanders to be built a stadium in Prince George's County in a couple of years when they hold an NFL draft on the mall. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So, like, he's not going to have the support of the NFL. Now, he also just, Trump just sued the Wall Street Journal over an Epstein article, and the Journal is owned by his good friend Rupert Murdoch. So, I mean, there is, not a whole lot of, like, rhyme or reason to, whether or not the things he does, and he's not always beholden to, whether or not he has connections or relationships. But, this would fly in the face of what the NFL wants. Donald Trump is very much into his positive, relationship with the NFL.
This is going to be fascinating. Like you mentioned, he could give up on this. He could have already given up on this today. He might actually take this and run with it. It'll be interesting to watch. Eric, appreciate the time. Go enjoy that press conference, and I'm sure we'll be having some audio with that based off of some of the things Miro Bowser says. Thank you for the time.
You got it, Tim.
That is Eric Flack. He was good enough to join us here on the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day sitting in for Kevin. He's the chief investigative reporter at WUSA 9. He's been all over the stadium stuff, really, the stadium reporting, since it has come to fruition that the team is going to be heading back to Washington, D.C. It is the Kevin Sheehan Show with Denton Day sitting in for Kevin. You can tweet me at the Denton Day. We're going to talk some Nationals with Bobby Blanco coming up in about 10 minutes, but we do have a little bit more time. We're going to squeeze in a few of your phone calls at 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. We'll try and get in as many as we can before Bobby, so I might go through a little rapid fire. Don't anyone get all in your feelings if I cut you off. We're just trying to get everybody in here. It's going to John in Oklahoma. John, what's going on?
Hey, first of all, thanks for taking my call, guys.
Of course.
Hey, listen, I've been out here 55 years. I'm part Native American, and the Native Americans, every day I talk to them, man. I mean, it's just every day. I mean, we got Rush Springs Redskins still 12 miles south of where we live. We got Indian City, USA, 18 miles west of where we live. The Native Americans out here, they tell me every day we talk about this, just almost every day we go somewhere and we're talking. They don't need white corporate America to take care of them, first of all, they say. They don't need anyone to take care of them. They're like, we know they're just trying to get wrote out of history books is what they're telling us out here. And if he's smart, Josh Harris is smart, this is his chance to change them back, not listen to white corporate America. And another thing they're not telling anyone, they're selling no merchandise. They're selling Jane Daniels shirts. But they're third to last in merchandising, third to last.
Yeah.
This is a team that was number one 20-something years ago. And people that think people aren't still fighting for it, been fighting for it the whole time, that just suppose they've been losing and stuff, that's wrong. I guarantee you. They've been people fighting for it the whole time. They've been trying to take it. And we have 34 American Native tribes in Oklahoma, and not one Native American tribe took a vote, the tribe, and voted it down. There was a few in each tribe that didn't vote for it 100%, not one tribe 100%. But they're like 8 out of 10 Native Americans, and every one of these tribes voted to keep the name amongst themselves. They know they can't satisfy the other 20%, but we're not going to satisfy 80%, they said, to please 20%. That's not how they vote out here. That's not how things are done.
John, I appreciate it. This is some real good information. I appreciate it. I have never seen the polls. I am self-aware enough to know that this decision was not made off of polling Native Americans. It just wasn't. There were people, Nike, that put a lot of pressure. Frederick Smith, because Dan Snyder did not pay him. It's important to really circle that particular aspect of this. This all happened because Dan Snyder did not pay his minority owners. He was costing them millions and millions of dollars, and they retaliated against him. That is just a cause to be a good person. We'll get one more in here. We'll continue to take some of your calls after Bobby Blanco. I think the conversation has been at least somewhat respectful today, so I'm proud of everybody on the phones. Let's get to Victor in D.C. Victor, what's going on?
Oh, hi, how are you? I'm just for bringing the name back. Family season ticket holders for almost 60 years. I'm black, part Native American, also gay, so I have that other's perspective. The real issue, just like your former caller, it's really not about Native Americans. I've spoken with Native Americans in Navajo country and Arizona. The vast majority of Native Americans are for the name. Historically, it was not an offensive name. Just go back to a dictionary that was no more than 20 years ago. It's an old term that just meant Native Americans. It's really about white corporate America and white liberals. I used to be a liberal, so I know it's the fear of white people with this name, and that's why, you know, I believe in it. At the very least, I'm also a realist, is getting the name retired with honor and dignity, like Redskins Hall of Fame. It is the Redskins Hall of Fame. So, you know, as a lifelong district resident, I just want the name to have honor and dignity like it used to. And I think that if we all work together and kind of re-educate people about the history of the name, that we can get there.
Victor, I appreciate it. Working together is something that we seem to struggle to do, at least in 2025. We will continue to take some of your calls after Bobby Blanco, but coming up next, we're talking a little bit of Nationals. What are they going to do with the trade deadline coming up here? Could a couple key players be on the move? Bobby Blanco joins us next. It's the Kevin Sheehan Show with Dent Day, sitting in for Kevin here on the Team 980.
This from E on Twitter. E on Twitter. I read it earlier today. Whatever you do, don't bore me with 3 hours of name talk. I got a lot of that yesterday. I wasn't on yesterday. Trust me, E. If I really was doing this right, that's all we'd be talking about today. But you can never go wrong when you're joined by Ben Standig. That is for sure. Ben's joining us right now after being a part of the Q&A group with Quinn and Peters during their press conference last hour. At Ben Standig on X, on Twitter. Last Man Standig is his podcast. And you do have a new announcement or a new place that you're going to announce, and we'll let people hang on for that, and we'll do that at the end. But Ben is setting up shop in a new situation. He is not with the Athletic anymore. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, their loss. But let's start with what you just heard for about a half an hour last hour. Anything strike you as significant as it relates to the Terry contract situation?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think these guys, it was Adam Peters and Dan Quinn, they took the high road, which was, you know, kind of expected, although, you know, you wondered after Terry was pretty candid with his comments last week about his frustration over the contract. But, you know, Adam Peters expressed, hey, look, we value this guy. We knew that before we arrived here, you know, in the beginning of 2024, and we certainly have learned that since, and that he hopes to get a deal done. That said, he didn't say we're close. He didn't say he knows for sure Terry's coming in today. I had heard that there was at least still some debate on the McLaurin side as of like yesterday that as to what was going to happen, if he's going to, you know, come in and hold in, or if he's out. And so, you know, I don't know that we're any closer to a deal, but they expressed optimism, and, you know, I guess at the moment, you know, it's all we can go on.
Do you have a hunch as to the specifics right now as to why they are apart, whether that is far apart or not that far apart? Is it, you know, age? Is it dollars? Is it years? What do you think the holdup is? Is it style in terms of negotiating style, like you and I have been talking about on this show for a month and a half? Peter's sort of adopting the San Francisco style. What do you think it is? What's your hunch?
Well, he said, you know, when he was asked just generally about holdouts, or, you know, not technically a holdout yet, but, you know, he's asked about these situations, and he said, look, you know, I going back to San Francisco, I've been a part of a lot of these, and, you know, they're, in his view, they're rarely straightforward. And, you know, you've talked about this, that the 49ers, when he was there, not that he was the one in charge of the contract negotiations, but, you know, he saw what was going on. And, you know, oftentimes they had players that the conversations lingered, you know, deep into training camp or right before the season starts. You know, I think as best I have been able to piece together, I think the money aspect is certainly part of it. I think that DK Metcalf, who is the same draft class as Terry, who is a much freakier athlete than Terry, but has not been as consistently productive, and that's not even factoring in, like, the locker room aspect and the community and all that. I, you know, so from the Terry side, I think they're like, hey, well, why can't, if he's gotten close to $33 million, why aren't we getting that? But on the other hand, you know, Harry is turning 30 this year. It's not old at all, but it is for NFL purposes. It's something to note. And, you know, look, I mean, as good as Terry is, we all get it. He doesn't have that one skill that you would say he's not the tallest. He's, you know, like he's really good, but he's not necessarily that has that different on the field that maybe you're looking for if you're going to pay somebody that kind of money. So I don't know how far apart they truly are, but you know, I've been saying $30 million for some time. To me, that still seems like a middle ground, but we'll have to find out. Terry was obviously pretty direct with his comments last week, and if he's really that frustrated and dug in, then maybe it's not, you know, maybe the compromise is not $30 million. Maybe it's, in his view, no, there's no compromise. We're hitting this. That's the part I'm not quite sure yet. To what degree is the level of frustration from his side, and, you know, how much is Washington willing to budge?
Yeah, you know, the Metcalf deal has come up several times. You know, they don't have to, you know, look at that deal if they believe Pittsburgh overpaid for DK Metcalf, because Pickens was gone and Aaron Rodgers was going to be the quarterback and he needed somebody to be able to throw the football to. It's a bit of a different situation. I mean, I get it. You know, same draft class. Metcalf's a little bit younger. I think the Amon-Ra St. Brown deal is significant in all of this. The two Detroit guys having negotiated 15, 16 months ago with a guy who was 24 in the moment is 25, you know, right now, going into his age 26 season, that, you know, he got just over 30 and 77 guaranteed. And most people around the NFL would say Amon-Ra St. Brown's better than Terry McLaurin and much younger. So, well, we'll see. I'm wondering if it's like, is it 30 that the team would be okay with, but Terry's much higher, or is the team, you know, giving him a less than T. Higgins, you know, offer, which could be perceived as lowballed, and he's up in the DK Metcalf range, you know. So that I was just curious if you kind of had any sort of sense as to where that is. I mean, I didn't hear anything. It was not super revealing other than him talking about the complications and talking about the expectation that they want him and they're going to keep working hard and they've had recent conversations. Maybe that was the news out of it, right? Is that he said that they have had recent conversations. He didn't timeline it, but recent would be maybe since Terry went off last week.
Yeah, yes, he did make that mention. You know, I know that, like, nobody wants to hear this, but, like, I've said this before, and I had Adam Schefter on my podcast, my new one that's up, and I talked to him about this, and he kind of said the same thing that I did, which is, like, people go on vacation, like, this is the one month where people get away, and not that you can't negotiate a contract from the beach, but, you know, they got lives, too. Everybody's got to kind of go away. I mean, Terry himself was, you know, based on his Instagram, was out and about, you know, traveling around. So, you know, it's part of that as well. So when Terry said the other day that they hadn't talked for a month, okay, that does sound a little peculiar. You'd think somebody would at least be like, hey, man, just checking in, how's it going? But, okay, you know, therefore you would think, okay, they're going to talk, you know, ahead of training camp, obviously. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't get the sense that it's some bitter feud that's going to lead to a trade demand or anything along those lines. I just think it's a discussion, you know, and look, Terry did, you know, had something similar 3 years ago. Obviously, that deal got done in part because Dan Snyder wanted the deal to get done to, you know, there was a lot of things going on, as there always were, and giving the most popular player on the team an extension. It's a pretty good way to change the subject for a minute. This isn't different here. This group is like, hey, we just went to the NFC Championship game in 1 year. We've got Jaden Daniels. We're good. We're not feeling pressure in that regard. So, you know, I think it's just that, a level of negotiation, but, you know, we'll see. I mean, look, and like I said, I think if Terry comes in today but holds in, I think that's a positive sign. It's an indication that they think something will get done. If he's out for, I don't know, maybe one day he's out to send a message and then he's in that bad day too, I don't know, but if he's out for a bit, then that may be then we have a different conversation.
Talking to Ben Standing, what else from, you know, their half-hour press conference stood out to you?
Yeah, I asked about Von Miller. I mean, Adam had addressed that a little bit, and I was just sort of curious because, you know, obviously we all talked about they need more pass rushers throughout free agency and in the draft, and then they really didn't do a ton about it. And so I was like, okay, was this really the plan all along, or did you see something in training, in OTAs and minicamp that had a make you think we need to do something? And, you know, I think he basically was like, yeah, we kind of knew we needed to do more, even though when we asked questions about it a few months ago, they're like, no, we're good. You know, we feel comfortable with the group we have. But, okay, they did what seemed logical. And obviously, you know, he said a lot of great things about Von Miller, both the player, the person. And, you know, I think all that rings true from everything I've heard. He was, you know, highly productive last year. Six sacks may not seem like an incredible number for a guy who's had double-digit sacks most of his career. But if you look at it in terms of sacks or you know, pass rush wins per attempt, he was in the top 10 along with the other guys. You know, we all talk about the elite pass rushers today. He just didn't play. He played less than 40% of the snaps, partly from injuries and partly just to avoid wear and tear. He's 36 now. So, you know, I think he can be an effective piece for them. They still, you know, long-term, I have to get a younger three down defensive end, but for where they were at, I think getting Von Miller was a pretty good move.
Yeah, somebody asked, about his off the field issues and the challenge of sort of sorting through all of that. For those of you that didn't know that there were off the field issues with Von Miller, he was suspended for the first four games of the NFL last year for violating the NFL's personal conduct policy. It stems from an allegation that he had assaulted his pregnant girlfriend back in 2023. The NFL did not clarify any of the details of that allegation. He's always denied those allegations and said that they were 100% false. Dallas police, that's where it happened, closed the case back about a year ago, but he was still suspended for four games last year, which obviously impacted his sack totals too, if we're talking football. But he, you know, they obviously did. He essentially said, right, that they, you know, it's a challenge to do the homework and find out, you know, all of the information, but that they felt really good about the person that they had acquired.
Yeah, he said he got a lot of unsolicited calls from people that Von Miller has played for in recent stops. And look, on the legal matters, I don't know what, you know, I don't know what to say. I mean, they suspended him. He served his time and, you know, or so to speak, and, you know, move forward. So, yeah, hopefully they've done their due diligence. It is interesting, though, and I've noted this with some of the other guys they brought in this offseason, that, you know, last year it seemed like they were looking for a lot of boys to build this culture up.
You broke up there. They were looking for what? A lot of Boy Scouts, did you say?
Yeah, you know, guys to help build the culture. And now this offseason, I'm not saying that everybody is a bad guy or a risk, but, you know, Laremy Tunsil, you know, there were questions about the chemistry with Houston, and Houston decided they needed to move on. Deebo Samuel, the 49ers took a huge salary cap hit to move on from him. You know, Marshon Lattimore, again, there's nothing necessarily off the field, but, you know, there's some questions, I guess, about, you know, his time with the Saints and just kind of getting along with everybody and so on. So, you know, they definitely have taken more risks, but that's, you know, in the name of talent, that's what's going to happen. You have to compromise a little bit to make that next step. And where they are now is, you know, they need to make the next step. Last year, you know, I think we all recall 500 would have been considered a big season. So to do what they did and naturally build off of that means, you know, going after some guys that maybe they wouldn't have looked at last year.
Ben, this is what you do when you're all in to win a Super Bowl. You take some risks on players.
Peters was actually asked a question about essentially about that. He kind of waffled. He went in between both of us. He was like, yeah, well, I think what we did gives us a chance to do both, win now and build for tomorrow. So there you go.
Well, I actually thought the answer on the window when he said, look, three of the four teams last year had quarterbacks, you know, on big deals, and we were the only one that didn't. I'm not even sure what window means. He said, where's the quote? I wrote it down. He said, hopefully our window is as long as we're here. Look, we all understand rookie contract window and what it means, but it doesn't mean that there won't be other windows when Jaden does sign a deal to make it happen, too. The window is as long as he's the quarterback and upright, really. It's just a little bit easier in these first three seasons with him on a rookie deal. We're talking to Ben Standing. Back to Terry for just one moment, because there was another question that I had for you, and I think we talked about this last week. What are you hearing, if anything, on the standoff, if we want to even describe that, having, you know, at least a little bit to do with the agent for Terry and the fact that Terry's his biggest client and that this, you know, is going to be one of the bigger deals he's ever done as an agent?
I mean, look, that, you know, this is, you know, human nature, right? I mean, everybody is looking to better themselves as good as they can. Now, obviously, the point of an agent is to better your client and help them, you know, to the best degree that you can, give them appropriate counsel. And, you know, by all accounts, his agent, Buddy Baker, seems like a pretty reasonable guy. He's had some other players of, you know, some note, but not. Yeah, not yeah, like Doug Baldwin back in the day, among others. But yeah, Terry is right now, I think, probably his biggest client. And yeah, I mean, look, here's the other thing, right? This is likely going to be Terry's last big deal, so it's not just, you know, whatever, regardless of whatever the agent may be pushing, it is, you know, for Terry. Hey, this is it, right? If I'm going to get
the
next, you know, whatever, it's going to be now. So. Yeah, I mean, look, Terry is Terry's a smart guy. Like for example, I'm not paying close enough attention to the Shamar Stewart thing, or like when Shedeur Sanders like seemingly was getting some like bad advice, you know, in terms of the process. Like that seems to be problematic with the agent. Here, Terry McLaurin's a very smart guy. He's not a fool. If the agent's telling him something that he doesn't believe in, I don't think he's going to do it. But yeah, I mean, I think they probably look at this as, hey, this is our chance to be a little bit of hardball. We had a great year. You know, this is the thing that's funny. It's like in Adam we trust versus Scary Terry. And it's the one player other than Jaden that I think if you're Adam Peters, you may lose that battle in terms of the fan, you know, perception. That doesn't necessarily change his negotiation. But if you're Terry, you probably recognize that to a degree as well. So, you know, it's a back and forth. And like I've been saying all along, you know, wake me up if this thing gets past this started training camp. Well, we're almost here, and let's see what happens.
You know, it's interesting, and we did this on the phones recently, like, would you be Team Terry or Team, you know, front office? He's not going to lose that battle with me. He just isn't. And it has nothing to do with Terry. I want Terry signed. I want him happy. I want him on a long-term deal. But I trust the team. They've built up enough equity with me here over the last, you know, 18 months or whatever it's been, that I trust that they're doing the right thing for the organization current and future. I think we took calls on it, and I think I was surprised at how many people felt like they would trust the team. Yeah, you're right. It would be Jaden and Terry 1-2 in that order in terms of just do it, just take care of them. But I don't know how much of a PR loss this would be if he ends up playing 2025 on the last year of his deal.
Yeah, no, and look, you know, we've talked, among our many discussions has been, you know, the value of wide receivers, and do you build on that? You know, do you add a second one on top of the already expensive one you got? Yeah. And I'm of the view you don't, and not that to say just because Kansas City and Buffalo and the Tom Brady Patriots did it this way, everybody has to. But those teams largely, you know, sort of chintzed out on receiver relative to the league because they had quarterbacks who could turn, you know, water into wine for the most part. And not that, you know, we'll still see where Jaden goes, but, you know, other than Terry last year, what did this offense really have? That's why nobody was expecting that much, because you had, you know, Zach Ertz, Olamide Zaccheaus, De'Ami Brown. Like, it's not like these guys had done that much. Or Zach Ertz had, but he's been hurt in recent years. And then with Jaden Daniels, suddenly they all look pretty good. And if you can think that's a thing that's going to continue to happen, maybe you don't think you have to invest as much at receiver. I think you do kind of have one guy, but maybe that one guy is a 24-year-old you draft in a year or two, not, a guy who's, you know, turning 30 and, yeah. you know, whatever. So, yeah, I think I'm generally with you. It's hard to argue with against whatever Peters is thinking because based on what we've seen, what is there to go against? But, yeah, again, Terry, what's he done that you would say, don't pay this guy? So, it's a really interesting discussion, and, I'm curious to see how it ends out, obviously.
All right. Before we get to just your announcement as to where people can continue to read Ben Standig, it is day one of training camp veterans reporting. What's the biggest storyline after Terry here early in camp? And I'm with you. I'm still not super concerned. I think they'll get a deal done. But after Terry, what's the next biggest storyline entering training camp?
I don't know if there's like a screaming headline storyline. I guess I'm just intrigued by, like the defensive line. Like I could, the offensive line's interesting because of, two new tackles, a lot of moving parts. We'll see when Sam Cosmi comes back. Dan Quinn didn't give us much of an update there. We can point to, Debo, Samuel, and Lattimore. But I'm kind of intrigued by the defensive line because so much of what was tough for the defense last year was obviously – the front seven, their inability to stop the run. And I know they were decent in terms of the number of sacks, but, talent's going to have to win out over scheme. And, prior to Von Miller, they didn't add a ton that you're like, oh, wow, this is a great move. And we don't even, Von Miller's 36. We'll see what he has left officially. So I'm just curious. And not just that, like, what's the rotation? Now that you add a Von Miller to go with, say, a Dorrance Armstrong and a Dietrich Wise, well, what about now Javon Kinlaw? Is he just really going to play mostly tackle? If that's the case, then what's going on with Johnny Newton? Is Johnny Newton going to play left? Well, wait, they signed Eddie Goldman, who's a run stuffer. Does that mean Eddie Goldman's playing in the early downs? And if that's the case, is Johnny Newton playing more off the bench? I'm just intrigued by the rotation and things like that. They have more bodies that I think are viable than they do spots. So I'm just curious because, again, if that position, it's not just about the line, but if that position isn't resolved, if they don't look at like they've improved, then it could be another tough year for the defense overall.
Real quickly, by what time today will we know if Terry reported?
I think like 5 or 6 is sort of the deadline. I heard the players are having their physicals at 3. Now, obviously, they're not all doing it simultaneously, but if it's at 3 and you bang that out in a couple hours, then probably somewhere in that range.
Okay. Tell everybody what you're doing. Ben is no longer with The Athletic. We talked about that a few weeks ago. Where will be you're going to continue to come on this show. And by the way, every day this week from training camp, and we'll see what happens in the next few weeks. I still am going to be I've got a few days off coming up too. But where can everybody read you?
Yeah, no, I'm excited. I'm opening up a Substack account, which is a really sort of fancy bloggy place. It's not a blog, though. I'm not a blogger. I'm a reporter, and a lot of other reporters have had success there. And, so it's going to stay the same name, Last Man Standing. I spoke to branding experts, and they said, you already got one thing established. Don't confuse it. So we're going with that across the board. And, if you've read my coverage, you can expect – similar stories, whether, I've written about Jaden Daniels' VR, his usage there and how the team's embraced it, how Adam Peters, found success by listening before acting, talked about Terry McLaurin finding his voice last year, not to mention a lot of NFL drafts and mock drafts, my annual agent survey, all that good stuff. But I think the thing for me, once I sort of sat down and just kind of thought about it, way back in 2018, I was getting super frustrated with not just the local market and how things were kind of being run by organizations, but also, the desire to get clickbait, right? The desire to have those ad revenues and what it meant for the types of stories that were getting run out. So myself and a couple other guys, we started our own subscription site, The Sports Capital, and I really enjoyed that because I was in charge. I mean, with the three of us were in charge, but it was all on us. There was no safety net. We had to do it. Now, we were fortunate at that time to get jobs, full-time jobs with insurance and things like that. So we ultimately had it where we were in our lives. We needed to do it. But now I get to go back and do it again where it's all on me. There is no boss. couple hundred miles away telling me what I should be writing about on the Commanders, or, you know, it's all on me for better or worse. And I think, you know, I'm excited that, you know, for people to come on board, build this community. And look, I'm saying this as just being realistic. I'm not a jab at anybody. As you know, the beat here is very different than it was back then. So, numerous outlets no longer cover the team. There's a lot of turnover. And, you know, I've been here for a while, so I feel like I got a pretty good read on things. And, you know, as evidenced by you letting me come on and rant with you. So I, I'm looking forward to it. I'm shocked, you know, me, I'm often a Debbie Downer, but I'm pretty optimistic and hopeful here that this is going to work out. So I hope everybody checks it out. Again, it's lastmanstanding, I think, .substack.com, or if you just go to the Substack site or app, you can just look for it there. And it is live now. I got a tweet about it when we get off here, but it is live, and go check it out.
You know what I've thought about you as a reporter, as a writer, as I think very smart, very astute, and I think you think outside the box, which is one of the reasons I've always enjoyed reading you and having you on. I think you'll do really well. All right, we'll chat tomorrow. Thanks.
Awesome, man. See ya. Thank
ben
you again.
Ben Standing, everybody. All right, I know that some of you are waiting for me to weigh in on the Trump stuff. I was off yesterday. I did do a lot on the podcast, but I'll just share some of my thoughts on the tweets related to killing the RFK deal if the team name doesn't go back to the Redskins. I'll do that next. And again, keep it here all day long. We'll certainly report when Terry McLaurin either shows up or doesn't by the deadline, and then we'll know whether or not he is a hold-in or a holdout. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. So everybody knows at this point, right? I think everybody knows at this point that the president, from his Truth Social account on Sunday, sent out some messages with respect to the original team name here, Redskins. I guess the original team name was the Braves way back in the early 30s in Boston. And that he was essentially calling for the team to change back to Redskins, or he might step in and kill the RFK Stadium deal. He did say he might, or he may. Eric Flack was on this show with Denton yesterday, who was sitting in, and then he came on my podcast later on, and Eric actually outlined how Trump could, you know, kill the RFK deal. There are like three different ways. There's an executive action canceling the lease. Remember, that land is owned by the federal government, and, you know, back in late December, it ended up extending, amending the lease for another 100 years, allowing them to, you know, cut a deal with the football team to bring the football team back. But there are other ways, like the National Capital Planning Commission, sort of construction people. He's got members on the board that he put on it. Same thing with the Commission of Fine Arts. There are Trump members on that board. They have to review design of all DC construction so that, you know, our city continues to look like the very unique city that it is. So, I'm assuming all of you know what he tweeted out. Obviously, this was a massive topic for about 24 to 36 hours, and it still is with many of you today. So my thoughts, and I'll summarize them. I'm not going to go as long as I did on my podcast yesterday. You know, number one is, of course, I would love Redskins to come back. And it wouldn't matter to me at all if the facilitator was Trump, Kamala, or anybody else. However it would come back, it would be totally fine with me. Most of you know I've never believed that this, you know, topic was anything other than very complex, very deep, very debatable. I always thought the, you know, summer of 2020, as it relates to the loss of this name, was all on Dan, but it still was absurd. It was silly. It may have been swept up in the summer of 2020 anyway. I spent many, many years, you know, on this show and others talking about this name and acknowledging that, you know, if I ever felt for even a split second that overwhelmingly the reference to Redskins was truly hurtful to a large majority of people, then I would have called for it to go away. But of course, the data that was always out there reflected the opposite of that feeling among Native Americans. Snyder is the reason we lost it. He stiffed his minority shareholders. Fred Smith took him out, you know, at the knees in the summer of 2020. And not only was Fred Smith a minority shareholder, but Federal Express was a top 10 partner and endorser and sponsor of the NFL. I always felt like that whole process over all those years that those were that were against it were, you know, in the business of being offended. Not everybody. Many people, it was very heartfelt too, including some Native Americans. Certainly, it wasn't, you know, 100% Native Americans that had no issue with the name. But I always thought that there was a certain, you know, benefit that some that fought against it were getting out of it, you know, and, you know, a bit of sort of a performative aspect to it for many years. And I hated the fact that, you know, it got positioned as dictionary defined, insensitive, racist. It's not that in every dictionary, as I've pointed out over the years. And somehow that was a conversation ender instead of what it should have been if you had delved into the details of, you know, the definition. It should have been a conversation starter. But, you know, back then it was like, if you actually think that the name is okay, then you think the N-word's okay. I mean, they talk about disingenuous for many years, anybody comparing Redskins to the N-word. I mean, any informed, intelligent person that believed that or that was really misinformed, that said it more in most cases was hyperbolic beyond, and really worse than that, just insincere. But anyway, I would love it to come back, and I wouldn't care who brought it back. But I don't think it's coming back. As I've said for, I don't know, a year plus, that ship has sailed, that horse has left the barn, and there are $26 billion worth of reasons why it's not coming back. Forget the fact that this president, you know, not, no political, you know, discussion here, but we're all keen observers to a certain aspect of the human condition, and we know that with him, there's a lot of stuff that's thrown against the wall, and if it sticks, great, or many thoughts and or tweets that are very fleeting that end up vanishing within, you know, a few days. I know he's talked about it, you know, recently, you know, the stadium and the name, but there's just as much of a chance that this thing vanishes from his mind as it gets pressed forward somehow. But, you know, you got to convince a private entity, and it's really the league even more than the team, and the league's sponsors and advertisers. It's a $26 billion top line business annually, and they're not going back to having to deal with that, no matter how justifiable we all feel it is that the name shouldn't have been taken away and that it would be okay for it to come back. There are business reasons for it not to come back. I don't want those of you that are still passionate about it to give up the fight. I just have kind of gotten to the point where I just see it maybe differently. And as much as I want it to come back, I don't think it will. And I don't think anything in the last 48 hours changed that. Now, there are some issues related to this conversation that come up every single time the conversation comes up that are not in the real world. I would say in the real world, this topic is less divisive than it is on social media. But my God, on social media, when this topic comes up, I read this on my podcast yesterday, and I'll read it again. And I when these days happen, I get a lot of this stuff. I get much more to the opposite of this. But this came from KP, who wrote, "Oh, Jesus, I can only imagine what tomorrow will bring. He wrote this on Sunday. I don't know if I can take 3 hours of you on the name again. You're such a loser on this topic. You're going to do a whole show on the stupid name that nobody cares about anymore after last season, and you're going to do it on the eve of training camp. Let me warn you, names and uniforms are loser topics for you. Talk about Von Miller, Terry McLaurin's contract, Witt Jr.'s big upcoming second season. Anything about the name is tune-out content. I'm sure you'll kill me on this, Kevin, but you know I'm right. This is the stuff, and I see it on social media on days like this, when name, uniforms, the whole thing. I just don't get the people like KP. For starters, let me just take the easiest of sort of confrontational topics as it relates to the name. Anybody that says what KP said, that nobody cares about the name or branding anymore, how detached are you from the team, the team's fan base, the conversation around the team, to actually believe that the name and branding issues are topics that nobody cares about, or maybe just only a few people care about? The most viewed team tweet since the championship game in Philly was the uniform announcement a week and a half ago. Well over 2 million views. You know, I've said this many times in the past. You know, the junkies would tell you this. Everybody that does what we do would tell you this. That the easiest days, and I wasn't on yesterday. I was off. I was coming back from a few days off. But the easiest days in our business are days like yesterday. Literally, the phone lines are lit before the show starts, and they'll stay lit for 3 hours or 4 hours if you're doing a four-hour show. It's a layup. So, KP, let me warn you, the name and uniforms are loser topics, is just horrendous advice. Horrendous. You have no idea how embarrassingly wrong you are. The only days that generate more of a reaction are like Mondays after games during the season. A Tuesday after a Monday night game, or a Friday after a Thursday night game. Other than that, the name is and the branding is number two. Now, how much longer will it be that? I have no idea. It's been 5 years since the name was taken away, and it's still a massively, passionate topic among fans, both past and present. So that's one thing. Like, that's the easy thing. Like, please, you have no idea how far off you are when you say nobody cares or just a few people care. Secondly, I just don't get those of you who essentially, like, he called me essentially a loser for talking about the name. Why? It's something I feel deep down. You know, not everybody that doesn't feel that way, wasn't a fan like I was and many of you who are listening, but it's something that is emotional. Brand attachment is real. It's totally real. And the loss of something like that is hurtful and impactful. I am so okay with you, KP, and those of you that feel like it's a waste of your time, that, you know, you find it to be ridiculous that people obsess about this, or that they're hurt by it, or they're impacted by it. You're entitled to that opinion. But don't try to shut down our feelings and lecture us about how much of a loser, or how immature, or how whatever we are for feeling that way. It's just so intolerant. Like, I'm not going to even go into my normal rant about, this is more of a family conversation versus for outsiders. You know, there are people that just don't feel it like many of us do. They can't understand. They can't begin to understand. But I'm okay with you feeling that way, but I'm not okay with getting lectured on the way I feel. Lastly, and this is the one that I really, to me, it's mystifying. Those that are, it's one of the more divisive social media aspects of the name conversation. When people, you know, say, like KP did, you're really going to talk about the name on the eve of training camp? You're really going to talk about the name after the season they had? You're really going to talk about the name and obsess about the name and care about the name when Terry's going through this contract battle? Like, what is it with people like you who can't conceive of caring about, talking about, thinking about, and doing more than one thing at a time? Like, yes, I care about the name, and I also care that Terry's contract isn't done. And will Debo report in great shape? And what's the defense going to look like? Like, why would you limit yourself to just caring about one thing at a time? Join all of us that tend to be able to multitask and care about and think about and do more than one thing simultaneously. It's a much more interesting position. It's a better view. It's more interesting. Honestly, I don't get that part of it. And I see it from people I even know who say, why? Winning's the only thing that matters. Why would you talk about the name? Well, because I can think and care about the name and feel the loss of the name and also focus on winning. Yeah, it's doable. I promise you, I can do both of those things and more than that. All the while juggling family responsibilities and work responsibilities and everything else. I don't know why people like KP, and there are many of you out there, are stuck on this. Stop it. You know, there's room for a lot of discussion. You know, still over the last couple of years, even in the wake of the loss of the name, I guarantee you the loss of the name has been an under-discussed part of the show. And by the way, probably to our detriment. Because if you did name a lot more people would care. But the season is here, and we got football to discuss, sort of, during training camp. And I can't wait for the season to start, because then you get away from all that, and you can just focus on the games. But I'm never going to stop feeling it. Never. Maybe I will. I don't know. I can't guarantee that. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. All right, joining me right now for the first time of hopefully many times to come, the new head coach of Maryland men's basketball, Buzz Williams. Buzz has won everywhere he's been, Marquette, Virginia Tech, and most recently Texas A&M, 11 NCAA tournament trips in the 17 seasons he spent in Milwaukee, Blacksburg, College Station, four Sweet 16s, and Elite Eight. It's great to have you on the show. You've been here for a few months, and I know it's been tough getting settled, especially with having to remake the whole roster. I just mentioned the three places that you have spent the last 16 to 17 years living in with your family. How has it been so far adjusting to, you know, a much bigger market in the D.C. area?
Yes, sir. Thanks for the opportunity to visit with you. Everything has been good. I think we've been here, well, I've been here a little over 100 days. And to your point, I think we were 6 years in Milwaukee, 5 years in Blacksburg, and 6 years in College Station. My wife and I got married towards the tail end of my career as an assistant. I started as a head coach at the University of New Orleans. So we've kind of lived all over the place. Our children were born. We have four children. They were all born at different stops along the way. It has been a long time since we've lived in a non-college town, and so it's been a good change of pace. Anytime there's transition in jobs, whether you're the head coach or assistant coach, there's a lot of moving parts as it relates to jobs and your staff and the spouses and the children and everything thus far. You never know because you haven't lived it yet, but I think we've tried to make sound decisions personally and sound decisions professionally. But as you mentioned, Kevin, it's all been happening at warp speed, and that's kind of what has happened, not just at Maryland. That happens everywhere now in college athletics within what the model has become. And so to some degree, when I was hired, it was somewhat later in the process than normal. And when there's zero players on the team, that's not a complaint. That was just a reality. And right. How do you make progress relative to not only making decisions for now, but trying to also position yourself as best you can with the future as it relates to the players that are available, whether that be freshmen, whether that be in the portal. And so our staff's done a really good job, in my opinion, of trying to make sure that we find the right people and the right families, but also the right talent. And so we've went at it as hard as we can, and we're thankful to be here. And not everybody has moved yet, but it's getting closer. And once summer session two ends, it'll take a couple of more weeks. But everybody's at different stages. Some of them are still in the hotels. Some of them are fully settled. And if you come to my house and you want to help unpack boxes, there's plenty to do.
One of the things that I remember from your introductory press conference a few months ago, and it was very funny, you were talking about one of your sons who was at, I think it was like East Texas Baptist State, and and you said, for those of you who don't know it, it's in Texas and it's in the eastern part of Texas.
he's reminded me of that many times.
Yeah.
That was a little bit of anxiety on my part. I apologize. No,
that was great.
I was a little tongue-tied on some of the things that I wanted to communicate, and his coach has mentioned that to me a few times, too. Free plug, but yeah, Mason is our youngest son, and he played there last year, and he's lived with us this summer, but we'll be going back. I'll have to move him back to Texas once we finish summer school here. So we tried to see if we could get him in the Division III transfer portal for non-monetary decisions, but for proximity to his mom and dad, and it didn't work. So we'll have to move him back to Texas in a couple of weeks.
Oh, okay. Well, what year is he?
He'll be a sophomore.
Okay.
Yes, so thanks for asking.
Yeah,
he'll be a sophomore.
So hopefully next year you find something much closer. But you mentioned the fact that, you know, you've been in college towns, you know, Blacksburg and College Station. Yep. You know, two coaches ago here, Mark Turgeon, he came from College Station to College Park, which was, you know, a massive change. He had been in places like Wichita and Jacksonville before. Have you had a chance to spend time with him or talk to him about the adjustment that he and his wife Ann had to make coming to D.C.?
Yeah, I've talked with Coach a couple of times. I've tried to be respectful to all of the coaches. Obviously, Coach Williams, Coach Drizel's family,
yeah.
Coach Wade. I've tried to, Coach Willard, I've tried to be respectful in honoring all of their work and time that they've given to the institution, while at the same time trying to do the things that I need to do. I have known Coach Turgeon specifically nearly my entire career. Obviously, he replaced Billy Gillespie. I was an assistant for Billy Gillespie. And by the time Coach Turge got to College Station, I had already became a head coach, but a lot of the players that were on his team when he arrived were players that I had recruited or been a part of recruiting. And so I have known Coach Turge forever, and he and I have texted and spoken a few times. I haven't had a chance to see him in person since I have been here, but it is I have a long list of things to do on my phone. Hopefully that I can knock some of those things off in August. And Coach Turgeon, seeing Coach Turgeon is one of those things.
How much did you know about Maryland basketball and its tradition and history before taking the job?
Yeah, good question. Transparently, Kevin, I knew probably the top shelf part of it. Most of my career, I have studied coaches more than I have studied programs. I've studied coaches more than I have studied players. Just because I grew up wanting to be a coach and wanting to learn from excellent leaders in all sports, not just in basketball. And so I was more familiar with the coaches at Maryland than I was the program at Maryland. And I understand in some ways you could say that's interconnected, but I have learned more in the 100-plus days that I've been here about Maryland and the program and the support of the program, the importance of the program, and what it means within not only the campus community, but the community and the state and the region. And so I feel very honored and humbled to steward what has been an unbelievable history. I've been reading several books since I've been hired, a little bit on the program, a little bit on more of the former players and former coaches. So I'm more educated than I was the first day that I met you. And so I feel blessed to even be able to be in this office and be in this facility.
You have probably, as you said, over the 100 days, learned a lot more. Is there one thing more than any other thing that when you spend time with Maryland people, they've emphasized to you?
Yeah, good question. I think today is the 112th day.
Okay.
I think what's been emphasized the most is just what a home court advantage Xfinity is. And, you know, that happens at other places, and it sounds like it's very much a part of the Big Ten and the difficulty in winning on the road, maybe more so than other Power Four leagues. That's one of the things on my list that I will study some in August as we start studying some of the Big Ten teams and style of play and some of their rosters is, I haven't heard one person that has evidence that has not mentioned among many things. The one prevailing thought is the advantage of Xfinity, the support, the crowds, the students, the season ticket holders, the longtime season ticket holders, like how important it is and how consistent they are in their support and what a difficult place it is to win at. I mean, I've even had other Big Ten coaches tell me that. And I'm like, well, I appreciate you telling me. Obviously, I haven't been there for a game, so I didn't know. But everybody, that has for sure been a prevailing thought.
Yeah, I asked you that question because I thought that might be the thing. Because I was weaned on Maryland basketball. You know, I grew up during the Lefty era. I was in Cole Fieldhouse. I was there as a student. And I've said for many, many years, in this city, there is no more electric atmosphere and more difficult environment than College Park for a big game. Now, you know, you may not feel it in November and December if a ranked team isn't in there, but for a big game, you know, the ACC coaches, the Big Ten coaches will tell you there wasn't a tougher place to play. I was actually trying to figure it out, and you already answered the question, but I realized that, you know, you got to Virginia Tech as Maryland had just moved to the Big Ten, so you never have at any stop coached against Maryland or coached in College Park.
That's correct. There is some symmetry in some of what you're talking about. A couple of things. When I went to Virginia Tech, the Big East, current Big East, had only been in place for one season. So the year we went to the Elite Eight, which was my fifth year at Marquette, we won, co-shared the Big East regular season championship, and that was when, in essence, that was the last game of that version of the Big East. And then what the Big East became was my last year at Marquette, and that's when all of this was beginning. The right. first round of the shift was happening
yeah.
as it relates to Maryland, as it relates to Notre Dame, multiple schools in regards to the shift. And that was when the shift took place. Obviously, it didn't affect me going to the ACC, but my first Division I head coaching game was in the Black Coaches Association tournament, which was at the University of Maryland in 2006, November of 2006.
Okay.
And we played Vermont and Hampton. So I have never coached against
right.
or at the University of Maryland, but I have played on the University of Maryland's campus, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, in 2006, Xfinity was about 3 years old at that point.
Yeah, I think Coach Williams mentioned in was it 2002-03 season, the first season
yeah.
of Xfinity?
Yeah, exactly. They won the national championship
right.
in the final year at Cole Fieldhouse in 2002, and then Xfinity opened the following year. So the you know the fall, early December in of 2002 into 2003. Exactly.
And so the last regular season game at Cole was in the whatever, March of 2002,
and
then
yeah.
later in that month, they won the championship.
Yeah, yeah, they crushed Virginia in the final game ever played at Cole, and won the regular season, and they finished ranked, you know, second or third in the country. They were the one seed in the East, and they went on to win the national championship, you know, beating Kansas in the semis and Indiana in the final. But that game against Virginia, the final game in Cole, was memorable. But about 2 weeks earlier, Coach, they had played Duke in a 1-3 matchup, I think. And it was part of that several-year period where Maryland and Duke may have been the best rivalry in the sport. And the building on that day at Cole, and Maryland won that game, it was insanity. And, you know, as great as Xfinity is, and it's phenomenal, Cole was even better.
And that has been, sorry to interrupt you, that
no.
has been something else of our generation, the generations ahead of us. That has been another prevailing thought about Cole Fieldhouse, so much so that this would have been early in my tenure when I was still living in the hotel. Coach Lashley's been an unbelievably kind onboarder in helping me with all of this. And a couple of times I had mentioned to him, hey, Coach, when nobody's around, can you just like, can I just have an hour of your time here or there? And just talk to me about Maryland, talk to me about the school, talk to me about football, talk just anything. And one of the times that we spent, he came and picked me up at the hotel. And this was like late at night. And he's like, hey, I'm going to take you on a tour. Nobody will see us.
Yeah.
And he took me
to Cole.
To Cole Fieldhouse.
Yeah, the football facility.
And I was like, oh, yeah, everybody's been telling me about this. What do they do with this now? And he's like, oh, this is our facility. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know. And, you know, it's like 11 o'clock at night, and it's just Coach and I, and we pull up, and I was like, Coach, this is, like, cool. And, like, I'm old now, so a lot of things I don't say are cool anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, this is like really unique that they have utilized and transformed Cole Fieldhouse into what it is now. It's at like past, present, and future, a lot of great stories and memories and experiences in that building.
Well, you know, right in the middle of campus sat 14,500. There was no air conditioning, so it would get hot as
wow.
hell in there. And it was an absolute, you know, snake pit to play in for opponents. And, you know, those were the ACC days and many ACC years in Xfinity but you would walk into that building and you would look down on the arena and there would be the Carolina baby blue uniforms going through layup lines and Maryland on the other end. Lefty really is the man responsible for making college basketball what it is in this area. I had the pleasure of being able to work with Coach Thompson at the radio station for many years. He hosted the show after mine, and Big John used to say, without Lefty, there would have been no Georgetown, because college basketball was nothing in this area until Lefty arrived in 1969 and said he was going to make it the UCLA of the East. But he turned Maryland into an absolute power in the 70s. And, Buzz, he had teams that would have been Final Four teams, but back then, you know, only one team per conference could go to the tournament.
Yeah, good point.
And, that building hosted Texas Western in Kentucky in the 66 final, which was the first time five black players started for a college basketball team. It was very historic, the place was. But, yes, now it's an incredible football facility for Coach Locks. All right, so you mentioned something already, but how much different has this year been for you in a new place versus your last few stops? Because no chance you ever came into a place and actually had to rebuild the roster from scratch.
Yes, sir. I try to handle all of this in the same way I would handle it publicly or privately, and just speak the truth. None of it do I say in a complaining tone. None of it do I say in an arrogant or egotistical way. This is the fifth time I've taken a head coaching job, but it's the first time that I've taken a head coaching job in the era of the portal and NIL.
Right.
And the previous four times and this time, there is no comparison. The only comparison is, I have to move houses, move states, move my family. That part stays the same, but whether you're in football or basketball or baseball, it's a different job. It's a different industry. And everybody's trying to figure out, like, okay, how does this work and what's the appropriate way? And nobody necessarily has all the answers because this just happened. And so there's not a lot of data on, okay, what's the best way to go about it? And so, you know, like when the portal began, I didn't take another job. I was already in a job, and one of our thought processes was, well, let's get as many good players as we can from the portal who are the youngest best players so that they will have eligibility remaining. And then as it unfolded, hey, let's make sure we develop great relationships with the young men and their families, because maybe part of the niche we can create is once someone arrives, no matter where they arrive from or what age they are, we want them to stay, and we want to have a plan and a vision for their development that we all are on the same page, the staff, the kids, the players, the families, their coaches, their agents. Because if you're constantly turning over your roster, no matter how good the player or how good your plan is, if it's ever changing relative to the people, that's hard to build continuity. And over the last, since all of this has started, we had among the lower transfer rates in the country. Is that because we had the best players? No. The best coaches? No. But I think the vision and the plan was very similar. And so when you take a job and you've never taken a job in this era of athletics, how do you want to do it? Do you want to sign all players from the portal? Do you want to sign all guys that are going into their senior year? Do you want to sign some freshmen? And so you never know, because it's all happening at warp speed. But we've just tried to maybe diversify as best we can while not sacrificing the character and the work ethic and what we want our program to be about relative to the intangibles. And so where are we? I don't know. Do I think our decision-making matrix, we kind of went about it in a systematic way, even though it was happening really, really fast? I think we did. But there's no way for me to compare Hey, when you left Marquette and went to Virginia Tech, what was it like? And when you left Virginia Tech and went to Texas A&M, what was it like? Or when you left A&M and came to Maryland, what was it like? Well, it was different than all of them, not because anything is wrong and not because I'm complaining. It's just because that's what the industry has become.
Right. You know, you saying the lowest transfer rates, I think one of the things we as Maryland fans and Maryland people have learned about you over the last couple of months is just how much your players loved playing for you and respected you. And we've seen a lot of those videos and highlights, and some of those players came from Texas A&M with you to Maryland. So, you know, given that you've got essentially 15 new players, I mean, Maryland's team last year, which made it to the Sweet 16, was a completely new team. But do you have a hunch at this point in late July about what you've put together and how it will play out on the floor when you get to November?
Sure. We probably handle the summers, Kevin, a little differently. But I would say that probably all coaches would say the same if asked that question. Maybe how you would utilize the 8 weeks you can work in the summer 10 years ago is different than how you would utilize the summer now. I think when you take a job and you have to put together an entire roster, I think then the summer changes even more. And I don't know if we've went about this the right way. Although we're in week 6 of 8, I kind of think that we have gained some traction. Number one, most importantly, in my opinion, is the relationship category. I want to spend some time with these guys. A lot of the things that players say about me, it's just because they're good people and they're covering up a lot of my deficiencies, to be kind. But I also think there is an element of my willingness to give my time to them to invest in their life. Every now and then we'll talk about dribbling better or trying to shoot a different ball, but more importantly, who they are as young men and who they're going to become. So I try to invest most of my time in the summer in getting to know who they are, what's important to them, what they like, what they don't like, how can I help them, what are their trigger points. And you can only do that through time. And so we utilized our first 3 weeks. We never practiced 5-on-5 whatsoever. Just because I wanted to be in the gym, I wanted to sweat with them, I wanted to actually learn their game. I think part of our jobs as coaches is to put our teams in positions to be successful. And sometimes you can have a system and you always get the best players, and that's okay. I think for the path that I have been on, I think my job is to adjust how we coach based on our personnel. And so the first 3 weeks of June that we worked, it was a lot of skill work with one guy, occasionally with two. Every now and then we would do with three guys. Once every 2 weeks we would do it with fours, just to – hey, I want to learn who they are. I want to learn their pace. I want to learn their motor. I want to learn how they think. I want to learn how they listen. And then as we have kind of unfolded the month of July, a lot of it's just been discovery. Discovery on, hey, would this work relative to our roster? And so we call them OTAs, just like you hear in the NFL,
right?
Organized team activity. And we just take one portion of what we're thinking about doing on offense and really drill down on that. Clips on that, numbers on that, take notes on that, show them film on that, and then do that, only that aspect on the floor. And if that fleshed out appropriately, go into OTA number two and build on it. If it didn't flesh out the right way, we go into OTA number two and try something else. And so we've had 6 offensive OTAs thus far. We're off on Wednesdays, which is why I'm doing this with you now. And then we start our first defensive OTA tomorrow. And so we'll start at ground zero tomorrow and what we do defensively. And there's a little bit of We're more convicted on what we want to do defensively because of not because of our personnel, but just because of how we want to play. But offensively, we're still trying to maybe connect some dots on, does this make sense relative to our roster? Should we expand that? Should we eliminate that? So those six OTAs, our guys were great. We made some progress. And then we're going to try to do the same thing as we start defensive OTAs tomorrow.
4 months away from home opener on a Friday night in College Park against Georgetown. I know you don't know a lot. I'm sure you've learned a lot about the history of the Maryland-Georgetown thing, but it looks like finally it's going to become more regular. And, you know, I asked that question not knowing if you would actually be able to, you know, have a hunch at this point. I would guess, correct me if I'm wrong, it probably takes until early in conference schedule to really know what you have, even in a normal year, right?
Yeah, I hope this is not clipped out and put on the internet where it comes across in the wrong sort of tone of voice or word usage. I think when you have a brand new team, every day is a brand new day.
Yeah, right.
And it's a brand new day, whether it's the summer, it's a brand new day, whether it's the fall, whether it's non-conference, whether it's conference. I think that I like, and I'm getting better at knowing who our group is. And I think one of the things that we've tried to do at appropriate times is try to teach all of us, not just the players, teach everyone on the staff some of the history that you know about the program, that you know about the institution. I think part of what has made Maryland so great for so long from a sustainability standpoint is not just the care and not just the support, but if you talk to this player or this coach from 20 years ago or 10 years ago, there is a connection. And I think we, as all of us are brand new, we need to get involved in understanding the history. I just had lunch. I never eat lunch, and I just had lunch because I had a visitor.
Why don't you eat lunch? They, you just don't make time for it.
Yeah, yes, sir. I don't. Yes, sir. I don't eat lunch. And so I had two people that I hadn't met that came to campus, and I had lunch with them, and they were telling me, and you probably know this, that this is the first time they believe in at least a decade that Georgetown and Maryland have played. Do you know if that's
Yeah, that we played in 15 and we played in 16 as part of the Gavitt games. Mark and JT3 scheduled back-to-back years, which was great. And by the way, Maryland won both of those games. They won in College Park in 15 and then in an incredible comeback down like 9 with 2 minutes to go. A guy that was visiting with you the other day, Anthony Cowan, as a freshman, was incredible in the comeback. And this has been a desire of a lot of sports fans and, of course, college basketball fans in this area that Maryland and Georgetown play every year. There were a lot of reasons. There's a lot of history. Gary will be able to, as you know, Maryland's greatest coach ever, be able to catch you up on all of that history. But there was some bad blood, you know, during those years.
Yeah.
But it's great that it's resuming, and it'll become a top five, top 10 date on the sports calendar in the DMV every year if Maryland and Georgetown play.
It's interesting. Thanks for the knowledge there of the history. It's interesting that you would say all that. The guy that I met with, he goes, "Hey, Buzz," he used some different words, but you'll get the gist. He goes, "Buzz, now let me break this down for you." And I go, "Yes, sir." And we're talking about Maryland and Georgetown. And, of course, I know that we're playing here and all of that. But I didn't know there was a 10-year gap or 9 years now. And he goes, "Buzz, this is what it is. It's the Cowboys and Redskins on Thanksgiving Day. You know that, don't you?" And I go, "Yes, sir. I grew up on that."
Yeah.
I know they may not play on Thanksgiving Day, and I know they're not called the Redskins anymore. But, yes, sir, I remember that. He goes, "That's what it'll be in here." on that night at Xfinity. And I go, okay, I appreciate that. That helps me. That clues me in. So I have great respect for Coach Cooley. Obviously, we competed against each other and have known each other. I think, actually, we both became head coaches at the same exact time. And so when he got the job at Fairfield is when I got the job at New Orleans. Right. So that'll be great.
That was Buzz Williams with me. There was more to it, and he talked about being a big Cowboys fan, and we talked a little bit about that. You can catch that on my podcast from yesterday. I'll follow up on some of the things he said when we come back. Ben Standing, 10 minutes away from Ashburn. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team 980.com.